It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Floodwaters in northeastern Iowa have inundated homes, businesses. They've breached a handful of wastewater treatment plants, also swamped a fish hatchery. Governor Terry Branstad issuing a disaster proclamation for five northeast Iowa counties. This is the extreme northeast corner of the state involving the Turkey Rivers, Turkey and Upper Iowa Rivers. This hour we want to take stock of the floodwaters, its devastation as those floodwaters slowly recede. We want to check in with some Iowans affected. Also, in a bit, we'll be joined by Witold Krajewski, who directs the Iowa Flood Center, and hear about that fish hatchery that had to be evacuated. We want to hear from you this hour as well. Have you been affected by the recent flooding? Tell us about your situation, how you're coping. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your question, your comment, or a short take on your experience. Let's first talk with Josh McGrath. Josh and his family have lost their home that is outside of Decorah in Fremont. Josh, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. We're so sorry to hear that your family has lost your home, but thank you nevertheless for joining us. And do tell us what happened. What day did the flooding come?
It came in the early mornings of Wednesday. We got the flash flood warning sometime around 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. We ignored it because we weren't in the floodplain and we didn't think we were anywhere near trouble. And then about 4 o'clock that morning when we heard our daughter screaming, did the water start coming in the basement, and that's when it all started.
Mm-hmm. Your daughter was in the basement? She have a bedroom in the basement?
Correct. We had two bedrooms in the basement. Luckily, the window that broke and the water came in, that daughter was upstairs sleeping with us. Otherwise, we would have lost her. And then the other daughter is the one that alerted us of the water coming in.
Okay, so you've got ground-level windows that broke because of the water that started to flood in. What did you do after that?
Once we got the kids out, the water, by the time we got out of the house, the water was already filled the basement. It was already the top stairs. By then, my truck was already under, and we were able to get in the car and get out. It took us probably about a half hour. The two main roads that would have got us out were already underwater. We were able to get on Old Stagecoach Road and go towards Waukon. So about 15, 20 miles out in order to get out and come back on 9 and be able to head back towards my father's place where we stayed for a couple days.
In the middle of the night, well, 4 a.m., early morning hours, still dark, that must have been terrifying for you and especially the kids to try to find a way out of this.
It was, yes. I mean, A lot of mine was adrenaline. I've been through not this situation, but adrenaline type situations before, and so I was all running on adrenaline. The wife and kids though were really freaked out, and it was really trying.
Mm-hmm. You returned the next day. Is that what you said? You could return the next day, Josh.
The part of the river part of the road was still underwater, but we were able to make our way through it and get back to the house and see the dam wall. There was still multiple feet of water out in our yard that we had to wade through to get into the house, but we were able to go in and see the damage and start the plan from there.
What did you see when you entered the house?
The water was about it was probably about 3 feet up on the first floor is where it was. It had gone down in that time frame. Now the first floor was the water had gone down. It was only in the basement at that point, but everything in the house was destroyed. We were able to salvage a couple of small things that were up on the first floor, but everything in the basement was completely destroyed. All the furniture, the TVs, basically everything we owned was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. What is the state of affairs now for you and your family? Where are you staying?
Right now we are staying at a friend's place in their basement, looking for places to rent at this point because the house is uninhabitable at this point. We were able to drain the basement down to about a half a foot, but since we stopped draining, it's back up to about 4 feet of water in the basement. We've already seen foundation cracks and a couple walls have fell down inside the house, so we don't plan on going back. So we're trying to look for a long-term running situation at this point until we can see what FEMA, if FEMA does decide to come in. If not, then we'll have to figure things out.
Mm-hmm. You're waiting on word for FEMA from FEMA?
That is correct. We got the declaration from the state that it was a disaster, but our household gross income is above that threshold, so we don't qualify for any of that. And our insurance, we didn't have flood insurance because we weren't in a floodplain. So we're basically waiting on FEMA. I'm not sure if or what we'd get from them, but it's pretty much our last hope at this point.
Mm-hmm. How do you understand that it affected you so severely and so quickly, even though you're not on a floodplain?
It made me a little angry, mostly because the house, we bought the house this past November, so we haven't even been in a year yet. It was built last July timeframe, but from talking to other neighbors, the area flooded back in 2008. So why it wasn't designated a floodplain at that point, I don't know. But the fact that we moved into if I knew it was in a floodplain or that it was, there was that chance of flooding, I would never have moved my family in there. I definitely wouldn't have put my daughters in a basement that would have put them at risk. So it kind of makes me mad at that point where why wasn't it a floodplain or why didn't we have that option?
How close are you actually to the Upper Iowa River, or was it a tributary there?
We are about, I would say probably a quarter mile from the river itself, from the bridge, but the water did come from that direction. The water came, the bridge is probably about straight west of our house, but the water came in from the south through the field.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't expecting it to come from there. We would expect it to come from the river, but or from the bridge, but it did.
What have the kids said? You've got young kids, I understand, 4 years, 5 years, and 9 years old. What do you remember about how they're reacting? What are you most concerned about concerning the kids?
Our nine-year-old's probably taking it some of the hardest because that's our nine-year-old son. We've moved a couple of times in our life between the military and then coming back to Iowa, and we promised him this is our last move, and now that he lost everything, it's been a little tough on him. He didn't want to go back to school. He didn't want to go out to a friend's place. So he's starting to get through it now. The five-year-old daughter is the one that was in the basement. She's been having nightmares, and she didn't sleep that whole Wednesday night. Now she's starting to sleep through the night, but she has to sleep within the vicinity of us.
Mm-hmm. Josh, we are heartbroken to hear about your case. Is your house in a neighborhood? Are there neighbors around you that are similarly affected, or were you more or less an isolated house?
The whole area is hit. The house right next to us is in the same situation. They're still trying to salvage their house. They have to keep pumping every day just to keep the water down. But I know their basement's completely ruined, and water got on their first floor, too. There are a couple of houses next to us that had water in the basement, and I believe there's two houses about a block away that had the basement walls cave in and laid off their basement as well.
Mm-hmm. Horrible.
And all of us don't have flood insurance because of the no floodplain.
Mm-hmm. Josh, what is your plan for the rest of the day, for the rest of the week?
Me and my wife just started going back to work, trying to get back to some normalcy and get back into a routine. But as of for the rest of the week, we're going to try and just push through it and keep on looking for a new place to live and cross our fingers and hope FEMA decides to come through.
Oh, we hope the best for you and your family and the others affected in Northeast Iowa. Josh McGrath, thank you for joining us. House, a total loss outside of Decorah in Fremont. Josh, we'll let you get back to it. And our thoughts and prayers are with you.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer talking now about the devastating flooding in Northeast Iowa. There were a proclamation for five Northeast Iowa counties as disaster areas. Water's now receding after last week's flooding. Let's talk with Lissa Blake, is a staff reporter for Decorah Newspapers. Hi, Lissa.
Hi there. How are you?
So I'm just, you know, shocked hearing about Josh's case and wondering how many are in his family situation?
Well, I know that our local Red Cross chapter has helped over 30 families. There are probably 100-plus families in the county between different areas that have been affected. What Josh was talking about there in Freeport, it's just this strange little enclave of homes in this kind of single, a couple block area of Freeport. They're not the homes that were closest to the Upper Iowa River. They're more inland, and it's just every house in that area is just, they're still running pumps just to try to decide if they'll be able to salvage their homes or not.
Mm-hmm. Freeport is the town. I think I was incorrect in saying Fremont before.
Yes.
Lissa, why wasn't there, I mean, he's saying a lot of his neighbors had no flood insurance. Is that something that surprises you?
Well, no. For some reason, they don't consider that area to be in a floodplain. It's close to the Upper Iowa River. I don't believe that area has ever flooded before. I talked to people that had some water in their basements during our recent floods in 2008 and 2012, but they had determined that that was, quote, groundwater as opposed to floodwater. So insurance did cover those. I believe in 2008, insurance did cover some of that because it was determined to be groundwater. So they weren't, because they don't live in a floodplain, they were not eligible for flood insurance. And it doesn't seem right, but that's how it is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there state or federal authorities on site? What are you seeing as far as the response to the flooding?
Well, we had the Red Cross and the Salvation Army were here. The governor came and toured Freeport on Friday. We've already had this, the governor's proclamation. However, if you look at what that really provides people, it's if your income qualifies, then you're eligible for saving your receipts and being reimbursed up to $5,000. People are hoping that possibly there will be a presidential proclamation, but I had heard a figure that in order for that to happen, there has to be countywide something like $4.3 million in damage. And our emergency management department has said that they still can't assess the damage because all the floodwater has not receded. So we'll just have to wait and see. He said that number is kind of fluid. Right now they think there's about $500,000 damage to county infrastructure, but we don't know about private damage yet.
Mm-hmm. Have you been out in the areas to survey
yes.
it yourself?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
What are the images that stick with you as a staff reporter for the Decorah newspapers?
Oh, well, it's just been amazing. One lady in Freeport who just lives kind of behind the McGraths, she was standing there. There was just a pond around her house. She said that the water had come up to many of these homes saw water up above the first floor of their house. She said, "This is all I have." She said, I literally left my home with the clothes that I have on my back here. And she was crying. And I mean, it was just, you know, what do you do? These people are left with nothing and the insurance company isn't going to help them. And I just, it's just a feeling of despair. You know, there's also, however, many, many people that have turned out to help. There's been many meals that have brought. People take sandwiches, pizzas. I mean, it's certainly been a wonderful to see the community effort of people trying to help those that have been affected. But at the end of the day, they're still left with these homes that are completely damaged, and they've lost everything.
Right. Financially devastated. I understand many, I think including Josh and his family, are turning to the Internet to GoFundMe.
Right.
To tell us about that.
Right. There's quite a few families that have posted GoFundMe sites for them, they didn't have flood insurance, and it doesn't sound like they will, if they get $5,000 from the governor, I mean, that won't even touch the damage that they've seen. But I believe there were five to seven families when I looked last time. And the thing about Freeport is that it is the property there. It is a little less expensive to buy a home in Freeport. So you see a lot of young families with children who have purchased homes there. So they're people that aren't super established, and they don't have a lot of, they don't have thousands of dollars sitting aside in a savings account in case something like this happens,
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully I think people are going to answer the call and help them as much as they can.
Talking with Lissa Blake, staff reporter for Decorah newspaper. Stay with us, Lissa. We want to get back to you. I want to talk with another person personally affected. Frederic Boudouani is with us. He's an El Cader resident. Now, this is a little bit further. This is on the Turkey River, a little bit further south, owner of Abu Nawas, and also going to do with a great restaurant there in El Cader, Shara's restaurant there, Algerian food. Frederic, we've been on the program before. Welcome back. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances. And tell us, what have you lost there? What's the picture like in El Cader?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on, Ben. Yeah, I wish it was under better circumstances. I also want to really express my sympathy to Josh and his family and the people of Freeport for their tribulations. It's devastating. For us, it was kind of shocking. I woke up Wednesday morning at about 4 o'clock in the morning. I do a lot of traveling. I was headed down to Des Moines. There was some lightning around. We hardly got any water in any rain in Al Cader. I didn't think much of it, so I started heading down to Des Moines. The minute I got to Ankeny, my partner Brian, he owns the restaurant here in town. He's like, I just got a call from friends in Decorah, and they got a lot of rain up there. I think it's going to be bad. So I started calling people, and then found out that upstream in Spillville, they got this incredible amount of rain, 10 or 13 inches of rain. Overnight, the Turkey River up there rose from 4 feet to 17 feet in like 6 hours. So you know you're downstream. So there was, if you had come Wednesday morning, there was hardly, the river was way below flood stage, but there was such amount of water that happened upstream, it was just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. So we started trying to move as much as possible from the lower level of the restaurant. So it's this gigantic task. We called family and friends came from New Hampton and to help us move stuff. We spent about 24 hours doing that, and then sandbagged, and then the river kept rising and rising and rising. The prediction was 26 feet. It ended up cresting at close to 23 feet.
To get a picture of this, the restaurant that you and your partner are involved with, Shara's, backs up on, it's right on the river. But and I've had the pleasure of eating at that restaurant and being back on the back balcony, the deck that faces that beautiful view of the river. That river is quite a ways down, and that came right up.
Yeah, that's kind of the amazing part. You look at it, there are some pictures and videos on my personal Facebook. You look at it, and it's a gentle little stream when it behaves, but when it gets angry, it turns into this really roaring ocean. It's really amazing. Mm-hmm. the sheer force of water.
What does it look like in downtown El Cader now? And we have to remember there are other really beautiful buildings in El Cader. The Opera House is one of them as well.
Yeah, that part of town was completely safe. If you can picture where the restaurant is, it was starting with the restaurant and looking south. So that whole area is the part, and the side that's facing the river, that's the part that needed to be concerned with. We ended up with 3 feet of water in the basement, and it's just a gigantic effort for cleanup. If there is one bright in this sort of misery and darkness, if there is one bright light at the end of this a very dark tunnel, is how the people of this community come together and the sheer power of will and survival. There was a scent. I've never seen anything like that. It was really impressive. There is, like I said, some pictures on social media. There was an 8 feet wall of sandbags, and that was built up in few hours by many, many volunteers and the fire department that worked to save the grocery store and all the businesses on the southern part of town. It keeps you, when you see the kindness of human beings in those under those circumstances, it keeps your hope going, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it cements the bonds in your community, I bet.
It sure does. I mean, you speak to people that you don't really usually have contact with, but they come together, and come and offer their help. And even if there is nothing else to do, just by them offering it, it means the world to someone.
Frederick, in El Cater, what is this? How does this compare to 2008, the great floods of 2008?
So to give you kind of a little measure, in 2008, the river was, there was about half an inch on the back of that patio. Kind of the measure kind of shift back then. They were saying that was 31 feet. This time around, it crested at about 33 feet. So if you can, this time around, it was halfway up to the patio.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So worse than 2008 by a couple feet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Most people insured, affected? Are you insured, you and Brian?
Since 2008, we had gotten flood insurance. We were dealing with the adjuster. This is sort of the trial run, so we'll see what would come out of it. We're hoping for the best and praising for the worst. Hoping we come out okay, I guess.
Are you seeing signs of other authorities there, Red Cross, FEMA, any others there at work?
I personally seen the Salvation Army. I haven't seen anybody else. They might have been here, but honestly, when you're going through, you're in your own little bubble, so you're working on your immediate world, so you don't have contact with much other people unless they seek you out.
Mm-hmm. What's in store for you and your partner Brian in the coming days?
Really helping, trying to help Brian and his restaurant to get back and running. I mean, it's just without any of it for a restaurant, this is kind of the last best hope for a busy season. So being completely closed, never mind that the damage is a big hit on a business. So we're hoping we can get him up and running by next Friday. So we need all the help we can get.
Okay.
And after we're up and running, come and visit Al-Qaeda and support everybody in Al-Qaeda. We would appreciate it.
That is a good sentiment to leave this conversation. Frederick Budwani, Al-Qaeda resident, owner of Abu Nawas, thank you for telling us. A very difficult time. Our thoughts are with you and the others affected by this devastating flooding. Thank you for the conversation, Frederick.
Thank you for reaching out. We really appreciate it. We appreciate all your listeners, and best of luck to everybody who got affected. Thank you, Iowa, for standing by us.
Thank you, Frederick. When we come back, we'll talk more about the flooding, also more with Lissa Blake of Decorah Newspapers. Also, Witold Krajewski will be with us, director of the Iowa Flood Center. If you've been affected, join our conversation. Tell us how you're coping. 1-866-780-9100. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'll be back in just a minute. And we're back with more of this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the devastating floods in northeastern Iowa over the past few days. Last week, their waters are receding now. We're seeing how people are coping with those devastating floods. Governor Branstad issuing a disaster proclamation for 5 northeast Iowa counties. In the first half hour, we spoke with a homeowner. He and his family lost everything. No flood insurance because they weren't in a floodplain. Also, we spoke that was outside of Decorah in Freeport. Also, with a business owner. We spoke with in El Cater. That's on the Turkey River, a little bit south of that. And flash flood there, even though not really much rain experienced by the community. Be a lot coming down stream, flooding part of that community as well. Lissa Blake with us, staff reporter for Decorah Newspapers. Lissa, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things you haven't mentioned. Is Spillville. What river is Spillville on?
The Turkey River.
The Turkey. Tell us about the devastation there. I understand it's pretty bad.
Well, I guess that the river crested at a record of 20.25 feet Wednesday. That was according to the National Weather Service, and the previous record was 19 feet. In 2006, flood stage is about 9 feet. And Spillville is kind of an amazing place. There are still some people who are without power at this point in time, but we just spoke with the mayor, Mike Klemisch, this morning, and they have the historic Spillville, the Inwood Ballroom there in Spillville, And they, it's a huge center of activity and things in Spillville. People have all kinds of parties, wedding receptions, things like that. So they had a huge number of volunteers turn out on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to completely clean it up. It was inundated by floodwaters. And apparently they think it's going to be ready for a wedding reception that's still slated to take place there this coming weekend.
Amazing.
Which is amazing. I guess there's a campground that is still full of a lot of sand. They said that will be an ongoing project, and that probably won't be finished before next year. But it's an amazing community response when something like this happens, and people, they turn out to take care of each other. So.
Several wastewater treatment plants inundated. How many by your count, Lisa?
I think that we had gotten a release that there were three or four in northeast Iowa. And ours was that quickly went down. And we got some different releases throughout, in just the days following. They were asking people to please conserve water. Now we have news that our wastewater treatment plant is keeping up with the flow demands. They're still asking that you try to reduce your output, but it's totally fine to use your appliances that use water. And that our Decorah and Freeport water supplies continue to be safe to use and drink. So.
And Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong, but once a wastewater treatment plant is inundated and cannot function anymore, waste just goes right into the waterways, right?
Right. And one of the releases I got just said, be aware that if this happens, untreated water could be going back into the water table. But that didn't happen here. I don't know if that happened anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Before we say goodbye, Lisa, what will you be focusing on in the coming days here? What do you think are the stories we'll see from your papers?
Well, we're just trying to just keep abreast of the cleanup and the aid, possibilities for people. Our recycling, I just was emailed a photo this morning, a drone photo of our local recycling plant. They have just tons and tons of water damaged goods that people are bringing and they're piling up there. People are still just, we have people stopping in and saying, where can we help? Or people are just showing up and saying, do you still need help? And so I guess I would imagine that we'll try to keep up to date on, if there's a presidential proclamation, if how people can apply for any sort of aid. We do have a local flood relief fund, which is awesome. And that's been set up, I believe, through our Chamber of Commerce.
How do people find out more about that?
They can go to our the Decorah Area Chamber of Commerce website, and I'm sure that they can, it says, donations can be made by writing checks to NEICA Flood Fund, and that can be, or you can call the Decorah Area Chamber of Commerce at 382-3990.
Okay. Lisa Blake, thank you so much for the details of the flooding in northeastern Iowa. Staff reporter for Decorah Newspapers. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, keeping up, getting snapshot of the devastating floods there in northeastern Iowa. Five northeast Iowa counties declared disasters by the Iowa governor. And the water's receding, people pitching in, as they always do, helping neighbors. Vitold Krajewski is with us as well in our Iowa City studio. He is director of the Iowa Flood Center. Vitold, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
So we've been hearing details. We've been sitting across from me listening to the painful stories, the loss of homes, of businesses, the damage, and so forth, but also the communities, their resilience pulling together here. Tell us about what your activities there at the Iowa Flood Center, because you're in the business of creating maps. Tell us a little more about that, flood maps.
Yes, and before I do, I would like to start by expressing sympathy for all the people who are affected by these events. This is also on behalf of my colleagues at the Iowa Flood Center. So our work is not only about the mapping. We are an academic research center, so we study all aspects of floods and flooding. One way to characterize our work is that we work to provide better information, flood-related information, to all people of Iowa. And that includes mapping of possible flood inundation. It also includes improving our methods for flood forecasting in real time and many, many other, you know, aspects. So where would you like me to start?
Well, I guess the aspect here, we heard from the homeowner there that they were not in a floodplain, they were flooded. How does that happen? And the flash flood aspect of this, when and these are maps that you are currently updating, your flood center, right?
Well, yeah. So first I want to clarify, you know, some things. So flood plain and flood zone, they may not be exactly, you know, the same. Mm-hmm. They may not have the same, you know, meaning. You know, flood plain is more of a topographic description. You know, flood zone is, you know, something that we designated based on some analysis of, you know, past, you know, data. So flood insurance requirements or recommendations, development, you know, permits, engineering, you know, design, those are all based on a certain notion of flood inundation. The popular notion that is associated with that is that of a 100-year flood. Mm-hmm. And so so as such, then clearly there is no hard line in the sand, if you will, where the floods could get, you know. So
I guess also what I'm asking here is, when you have a flood event like this with evidently surprises there, is this something that you take in the data to use to revise floodplain, flood region maps?
Yes and no. So yes, but not in a short term, not immediately. So so in other words, that the analysis that we do is based on statistical, you know, description of the past records. So each flood is just a small portion of that, you know, record. Big floods, of course, have bigger influence, and they can, you know, move this extends, you know, quite a bit, but still they remain just a statistical, you know, concept, and so there is a good deal of uncertainty associated, you know, with them.
Okay, so you can make your flood maps, but even when you do, it's not 100%. It's a lot of uncertainty.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing floods more frequently in parts of the state over the last couple of decades? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there is, you know, some evidence that there are some increasing, you know, trends in the frequency and perhaps even magnitude of floods. These are not very strong, you know, trends, and there are some places that don't show any trends. This is all because we are talking about infrequent events. So by definition, they don't happen, you know, frequently.
But they are happening more frequently than 100 or 500 years, right? Their names are not quite matching with what they should be doing.
That is correct. So this is very unfortunate that terminology kind of escaped, as I say, the technical, you know, community, because there is a very precise, you know, meaning that is behind, you know, those notions. But that meaning is not that these events can happen once every 100 years.
What is the meaning then?
So the meaning is that every year, if you are, say, in that flood zone designated by, let's say, this notion of, you know, 100-year flood, each year your chances of being affected by an event like that or larger are 1%. Okay? And that probability, that chance does not change from year to year. On the other hand, very few people know that if you, say, buy a house in a zone like this, and let's say you want to keep that house for 30 years, that your chances of being flooded by an event like that over sometime during those 30 years are 26%. So we go from 1% to 26, you know, percent, and of course, if you stay longer, your chances increase.
Right.
Very few people know about, you know, this.
Does climate change have anything to do with the increase in frequency? You said a slight increase, but what are the factors that you can imagine that you see feeding into more flooding?
Yeah, so probably climate change, you know, contributes. How much it contributes versus other, you know, factors, it's difficult, you know, to tell. There are some other, you know, factors. There are changes, significant changes in the land use. We lose here in Iowa, we lose soil to soil erosion. Soil acts as a buffer of sorts because you can store water
in
the soil.
It's like a sponge.
Like a sponge, exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a smaller sponge, then you can hold, you know, less water, you know. And so there is a variety of factors that contribute, you know, to this. And, of course, you know, the climate, you know, factors, you know, that relates to global, you know, changes in the atmospheric, you know, processes and weather patterns, you know, and so forth.
Vito Krajewski is with us, director of the Iowa Flood Center, commenting on mapping of flooding and what we're learning about flooding, predicting flooding, a lot of uncertainty still in the business of predicting flooding on this edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kieford. Also joining us now toward the end of our hour, Gary Siegworth is with us, a natural resource biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Gary, welcome to our program.
Oh, hello from the remote oasis of Big Spring Trout Hatchery.
Okay. So, yeah, we want to talk to you about that. You have a trout hatchery. I think it's where is this one?
It's located about 10 miles upriver on the Turkey River from Alcater.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is unusual. You are the fish have been evacuated?
Well, some of them have been evacuated. You know, we went through this in 2008 and basically got inundated. And, you know, you try to weigh this out because we try to use all the information. You were just talking to someone from the flood center. You know, we're trying to gather everything we can to make decisions on what to do because it's a lot of effort to move all these fish out. But when we flooded in 2008, the gauging station at El Dorado was 21.5, okay? And we got hammered 3 feet over our levee. This year, it was 3 feet above that level, yet then we didn't quite flood out, and it's because of a number of factors. A lot of the tributaries in coming into the Turkey below there didn't get that high of a rainfall, so that there was some buffer there, which is why we didn't go under. But we didn't know that till after of where it was going to be out, so you got to make this decision of because last time it happened, it was a mess, and the thing we got out first were the small fish, the fingerlings, because we can't get those back. Those are the fish for next year, and we really never took out all the big ones, the catchable size fish, because last time in 2008, we were able to actually recover most of those after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Tell us why. I'm sure it sounds like a silly question to you and those who actually do this, but it's a flood. You've got water. Why do you need to evacuate fish?
Well, that's a good question. And if you've ever been to Big Spring Trout Hatchery, it's our largest spring in the state. And I kind of like to call us a mini New Orleans because trout are cold water species. The Turkey River is a warm water river, so you know they can't live in the Turkey River in most spots. So we're rearing all those fish, and when the river comes up, we're actually below the river's levels above where the trout are, and the spring flow has to be flowing through all of these raceways where we rear these fish. And so, them swimming away isn't, number one, they would be lost. But first of all, there'd be a lot of mortality. And so, you know, it isn't just a matter of fish being in the water. They're in these raceways and they're by size. And there's a lot of organization related to that. Why you don't just want them to just be in the water.
They would definitely not be happy in these raging streams and rivers.
No, I mean, because of me, you know, and I don't know what the temperature was exactly of the Turkey River, but they, you know, we would have just, all the small fish would have been all the catchable, or all the fish that would have been used for next year for all of our trout stocking throughout Northeast Iowa for the catchable stocking program.
You would have lost a generation.
Exactly, yep, or at least parts of them. There's three trout hatcheries in Iowa. There's Manchester, Decorah, and Big Spring. And where we were moving some of those fish was to both Decorah and Manchester. And even we were bringing to Decorah, despite all the chaos that was going on up there, the hatchery at least wasn't going to flood out.
Can you say at this point how much of the fish hatchery yields are lost because of this flooding?
Actually, you know, we worked throughout the night because we waited to make the call because, you don't just want to move fish and do all the stuff because it's a lot of work, days of work. And so we waited till kind of late to make the call, but we worked all night long and all the next day hauling fish. You know, everybody comes together to do this. You know, anyone that ever questions the dedication of people in natural resources, if they could be there and see these people just coming together and pitching in all hours of the night. I mean, several of us never got any sleep for 48 hours and of getting all this done.
So how many fish did you move in this period?
We moved about 200,000 or 225,000, maybe mostly small fingerling fish that were, you know, maybe 3 to 4 inch size fish.
And they're temporarily where?
Some are in Decorah, some are at Manchester, and so now all that has to be redone, and we have to reverse everything we did and get all those fish back here because they can only hold them temporarily. I mean, we only have so much capacity, which is dictated by how much water supply we have and at each of the hatcheries. So they can't hold them very long, so we're going to start moving them back here on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. How many people involved? Is this purely DNR people?
Yeah, and there's a few other people that volunteer, but, you know, we're pretty remote, you know, while everything else is going on in Alcater and other places, people everywhere, we're pretty remote, and, you know, nobody even knows we're out there and all this is going on, and even to make it worse, I mean, we lost our phone line, we had no communication with the outside world other than coming to the top of a hill with a cell phone, and so it gets pretty, it gets difficult for communication and knowing what's going on upstream at certain times.
Is that where you are now, at the top of a hill with a cell phone?
You bet. I climbed up here so I could talk to you.
Okay. So can you see the flooding from where you are now?
No, the flooding, I mean, it was a very quick flood. And I was listening to some of the, while you're talking about why are we having flooding worse than we are and things like that, which I would like to comment on. But you know, it came up. It peaked Friday about 5 a.m. We peaked and got about 4 inches from the top of the levee, so we were very close. But it's dropped very quickly. I mean, I'm already back down to normal operation where I could, it's all flowing by gravity back to the river. It was a very flashy high water event that dropped back very quickly back into the banks.
Mm-hmm. So we've only got a minute or two left. So please give us your thoughts on the flooding events and the
sure.
apparent more frequency of the flooding events that we've been experiencing.
A simple analogy I like to give is that in our record flood of 2008, that was 8 years ago, and I always like to say if we had the exact same water event as we had in 2008, the flooding would be worse. And why? Because we can't do anything about the rainfall events. I mean, these rainfall events are historical. You get these once in a while. What we can do something about is what happens to the water once it hits the ground. And there's no doubt we've sped off the delivery of the water from the land, and it's higher once it gets there because of accumulation of silt on the floodplain, which takes up floodplain capacity. What I would like to see is what would happen with that same event if in the watershed, you know, a lot more acres were in no-till and other conservation practices that soak up that rain and take 2 inches of that 8-inch rain and soak it right in. These peak floods would not be to the capacity they were. And we can do something about that, and we are working at it, but it's a slow process to get, you know, to change the way what we're doing on the land.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple solution.
Right. Very, very quickly, do you see us reversing that? I mean, within the next 5-10 years, or is it a longer-term project than that?
If it's voluntary, it's longer term because it takes a while. I mean, there's many reasons why, you know, people do, you know, the tillage and things like that the way they do. And, you know, until, you know, it spreads by kind of people example and things like that. But if you could watch a rainfall simulator and look at the difference between what soaks in and flows off between no-till and conventional tillage, it's striking that the difference. And then multiply that to 1 million acres in the Truckee River watershed, and the solution is right there. But the timing of it, I don't know. It's a matter of a lot of factors.
Okay, Gary Seekworth, that's all the time we have today, natural resource biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the extra effort and time you and your colleagues have put in to save trout and other aspects of the wilderness, wildlife out there. Gary, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and Witold Krajewski, thank you for coming in here as well into our studio in Iowa City, director of the Iowa Flood Center, for sharing your thoughts and your data as well.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our Executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.